Blog Talk Radio.
You've been gone.
Welcome to the Central for Repatriation Assistance Program, Repat Podcast. I'm glad to have you here for another series in our Central for Repat Podcast. We want to welcome you to the show. And also, I want to let you know that our main mission here at the Central for Repatriation Podcast is just to spread the awareness of the program that we have going on. We are Sanko for Repatriation Assistance Program. We're assisting our brothers and sisters here in the diaspora to repatriate and set up businesses on the African continent. So to find out more information on our program, please go to our website at sankoforepat.com. That's sankoforepat.com. That is where you can get more information on our program. And also, I'm going to give out the information on our social media streams where you can find more information on our program. You can find us on Twitter at Program Sankofa and also on Instagram at Sankofa Repatriation. Also on YouTube, our YouTube is Sankofa Repatriation Assistance Program, and the same for our Facebook, Sankofa Repatriation Assistance Program. And we do advise you and encourage you to follow us on our social media streams. That is where you'll get the latest updates on the activities that are taking place within the Sankofa Repatriation Assistance Program. So do make sure you follow us on our social media streams so you get the latest updates. Coming up on the show, we have a very special guest call coming out of Sierra Leone. We have Fode, and he will be sharing with us some of the work that he is doing in Sierra Leone. So, and also, we do have our co-host today, Adriana. She should be here with us. Are you there, Adriana?
Yes. Hi,
okay.
Thank you.
Not a problem. Welcome to the podcast. I do believe this is your first time co-hosting, right?
Yes, sir. Thank you. And I'm very blessed to be here.
Not a problem. I'm sure the listeners are glad to have you. So we're looking forward to a great show. just to take care of a couple of items, one of the things we want to mention to our listeners is that we do encourage you to go to our website and consider donating and becoming a monthly Patreon contributor to assist us on our mission of helping our brothers and sisters setting up businesses on the African continent. We do ask that you donate as little as $1 per month. And we have seen where people have been donating much more than that. So as little as $1 per month, and we are very thankful for that. And that is at Sankofa Repatriation Assistance, sankofarepat.com/donate. That is where you could help us to get to complete our mission of assisting our brothers setting up businesses on the African continent. Also, we do have an upcoming event in the D.C. area. Adriana, you want to talk a little about that?
Yeah, the program definitely is a really good initiative to, just like you said at the beginning, to spread awareness for the St. Croix Repatriation Assistance Program. So it's going to be, you know, coming up very soon in March.
Yeah. I think this one we're talking about is May 6th and 17th.
Oh, sorry,
so,
in May.
Yeah, so later on we're going to give out some more information on that. Also, I want to let them know that appearing at that event will be Chief Nana Obakese, and he will be talking about the 5,000 acres of free land in Ghana. So that's a very exciting event. We're asking our people to consider purchasing their tickets and to attend that. We're going to jump right into it and get to our special guest. Our special guest is Fode Ajamu Mansore, and he is doing a lot of great work in the Sierra Leone area. He is serving as ambassador of West Africa under the UNIACL Rehabilitation Committee for the 2020 parent body. And also he is the founder of the Black Star Action Network International. He also serves as president. He also serves as president of the UNIC, president of the UNIACL, Freetown. There's a lot of I's and A's there. So president of the UNIACL Freetown, that is chapter number 232. And with no further ado, we're going to bring on our very, very special guest, Fode. How are you doing?
Yeah, greetings, brother. Greetings. Thank you very much for having me on the program tonight. Special shout out to Sister Yah, you know, for kicking the movement off and getting things going. It's an honor, it's a privilege, as well as to the co-host as well. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, and it is our pleasure to have you here, and we do look forward to all the great information that you will be sharing with us. And I also want to, you know, commend you on the great work that you are doing. I've seen a lot of videos where you have been interviewed, you're giving tours, and I must commend you on the work you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you very much, man. Well, I can't do it alone. You know, there's a whole lot of people involved, and it's a collective movement, man. I just happen to be the face that you see and the voice that you hear, but what you see is the people in motion.
Okay, you know? great. And that is the concept that we try to push amongst our people. There is actual strength in numbers. Yep.
Absolutely.
Okay, so,
absolutely.
Okay, great. So I'm just going to jump right into it, Fode. So why don't you start with telling us a little bit about your background, you know, share with us how did you start to, you know, embracing your Africanness. Me, for one, you know, I grew up in the education system in Jamaica where, you know, you're fed the whatever is taught in school. And it was after my schooling that I went on my exploration journey, and I started researching some of our national heroes in Jamaica, and one such hero Bobby. And when I started, you know, looking into all the work that he had done and what he was able to accomplish, my conclusion was Marcus Garvey was well ahead of his time. And that's how I came about, you know, being able to dig further, you know, and embracing our culture. So why don't you give us a little about your background and how did you get to where you are now?
Well, absolutely. Thank you very much. Well, I was born and raised in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the son of a woman who now she's late. She transitioned back in 2014. But she was a great, great woman. She was a spiritual person, a minister, a community servant, and ultimately a mother, you know, to so many other people. than just the children that she had. So I had a home influence that kind of already preset me to be in kind of a position where I would like to serve and like to see community organized and things like that, because that was a home experience. But in terms of actually coming in contact with Africa, that happened at a very young age for me, fortunately, as well as my siblings, because my mother was born and raised in Orangeburg, South Carolina, and we're Gullah Geechee people. And, you know, there was a lot of little things, it was a lot of little remnants of Africa within my home experience, but back then I couldn't identify as African. I just knew that it was my, you know, my family's culture. Even from the language, I had one uncle named Bunk, and Uncle Bunk, he sounds just like the people here in Freetown, and it was just like, you know, he was talking Geechee, and my mother would talk to her family in that same vernacular, in that same language, and so I was exposed to the culture of Geechee, although I was born in the diaspora, because I was born in Pennsylvania, of course. That's far away from the low country, far away from South Carolina. But my whole household had been born and raised in South Carolina before I was born in the North. My mother, she gave birth to 16 children. And so she had a whole generation of children before I came into play in 1979. So one of the things in my family was an oral tradition, a legacy of knowing at least one African ethnicity that our family had claimed since the slave time, that we are Mandingo, that I had an ancestor, his name was Charles McClellan, and that he himself claimed to be a Mandingo. And it's very interesting because he was born into slavery in Ridgeville, South Carolina in 1840, but then he ended up fighting in the Civil War as a USCT, a United States colored troop. And then after the war in 1865, he went back to the military to now defend the new won freedoms as they perceived them then. But this time he went to the U.S. Navy. By 1880, he farmed over 50 acres of land, and he changed our family name from the original name, Smith, and I believe there was also another name, Wright, because he was allegedly, according to our oral tradition, he was actually kidnapped from one slave owner and was held captive by Confederates until he was released, until he was rescued during the war. Yeah, so that's our family oral tradition. And that man, he's like the great forefather for all of us. We're in the thousands right now. Him and his wife, who happened to be, she was born in Orangeburg, South Carolina. This is where Orangeburg comes in. She was born there into slavery. And you know, she also was a Geechee, but they had 12 children. They had 12 children fresh out of enslavement. They got married, and they had 12 children, and they farmed 50 acres of land in Ridgeville before 1880. And so that's the kind of family that my first generation out of chains kicked off with. So we have a sense of pride. Mm-hmm. Education has always been emphasized, along with school and church school, Sunday school. We also had home school in my house. You know, I can barely remember learning my alphabet and my numbers because it's like I always knew them. It was like my elder siblings naturally within our culture were responsible for teaching us those things at home. You know, so it was like that. Early on, my mother, she kept a bunch of encyclopedias in the basement. I used to find myself down there looking through encyclopedias, just excited about information, just about the world out there. Mm-hmm. And kind of moved me to always be somewhat of a researcher, someone trying to look for the truth, the answers. And later on, man, you know, by the time I was 13 years old, 1992, you know, I was influenced by the thriving hip-hop energy, you know. I was influenced by the Rodney King riots and things like that. I began to feel myself politically. I began to understand where I stand at politically through those kind of things, even in my youth. And then You know, so I always had a planted African seed within me, like that. You know, I remember my mother buying us African clothes. You know, I went to school with an African shirt. You know, people laughed at me with a dashiki, but I didn't mind. You know, my mother wore them. My mother had a gold tooth smile. Literally, she wore a gold tooth. You know, so it was like my mother's father, he was from Jamaica, Montego Bay. My mother's grandfather, he was from Haiti. And so I have a diverse ethnic background that I already knew since a child. Wow. And so I always identify with Jamaican culture and people strongly, Haitian people strongly, and I always was in search of learning more about Mandingo people. About the age 14, 15, I was doing community service at a local library in my hometown, and they had me emptying the garbage cans and cleaning the bathroom. But whenever I got done early, I would waste the rest of the time, or I would say I would use the rest of the time. I would go to the Black American History section and, you know, just browse through books, just like people kind of browse through Google right now to find information. And, you know, I became very impressed with our history as I began to read it. I remember the first time that I heard about the Mali Empire, I learned about Mansa Musa, and then it was like, he's a Mandingo, and I was like, what? That's what my mama said I am, you know? It was a wake-up. I was like, okay, that's a Mandingo. So I began to go farther and farther into that. So I'm not a African ancestry DNA tester. I am a Gullah Geechee. I'm a repatriate. I've been here since 2013. My background in terms of my work, I've done work in terms of social entrepreneurship. I've done work in terms of community organizing. I've also done work as like a event promoter. I've organized tours and things like that in my private life. I've also had a brief history with entertainment. I love hip hop. You know, I had a little bit of bars in me. I had to get them out, and you know things like that. So, in 2007, I was involved in organizing with a group that was organizing with people in Africa, and I was like, yo, this is dope. Like, I would love to like organize with people in Africa, because by then my political and historical consciousness had developed to the point that I knew in my heart and in my spirit that I was going to Africa. There was no doubt about it. It was just about how it was going to happen after that, because, you know, I'm very dark complexed compared to most people, and I'm six foot six, and I don't like white authority. I've never been bashful about that, and I just seen the way that the country was going. I was involved. I was a political activist. You know, I serve my community. I have respect where I'm from. People know me very well and still stay in contact with me. You know, my family is not a family that said, oh, you went to Africa, forget about you. My family is behind me. They support me. In fact, my sister, my younger sister is organizing a tour for December right now, where she's bringing even cousins and other people just to come to Sierra Leone, because we all got the same Gullah Geechee root and connection which we can talk to a little bit more.
Yeah, yeah. It's good that your sister can reach out to other
So basically, in 2007, I met a Pan-African journalist who was traveling on a speaking tour in Philadelphia. And from there, you know, we just kind of hit it off. You know, I was functioning as an international outreach coordinator, and I just wanted to really have a special connection to Sierra Leone, for one, because it's like, if you really want to serve the people, you should find the people that really need the service that you provide more, you know.
Yeah.
I won't walk past the person.
One thing I noticed about Sierra Leone is that it is rich in the Gullah Geechee group. There's a lot of the Gullah Geechee people do live there. And I must tell you that, you know, growing up, a lot of you know, non-education happens. Because it is only recently that I'm learning about Mansa Musa, Gullah Geechee. You know, why wasn't I taught this in school? And I must tell you, it is very commendable that your family was able to change their name early on, because that's something a lot of people want to do. One thing I want to mention also about the Gullah Geechee is that I've read a little article lately where it was comparing some of the words from the Gullah Geechee language to some of the words that we use in Jamaica. And funny enough, they are spot on similar. They're spot on similar.
Well, there's a reason.
Very touching to me.
Yeah, there's a reason, man. And if you don't mind, I would like to go into that.
Yes, please do.
Okay, fine. Well, as we know, they took Africans from the same places in Africa, same region, and then scattered us into thousands and thousands of plantation systems throughout the Caribbean and the United States of America and Mexico and Brazil and all over the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every plantation would have its own group, or every colony would have its own group that would develop its own cultural system as a consequence under that kind of under that kind of subordination. And so there became a need for a language to evolve in the mouth, on the tongues of the enslaved, that would be very difficult for average European to understand. Indistinguishable language that we could have that would be ours and would be influenced by. It would be it would have a lot of African languages and tones and things like that inside of it. It would keep our rhythm and our style of talking, you know, all those things within it. And it's not like it was a deliberate process. Like, we had some scientists sitting around planning our cultural resistance. But it was a natural thing, because it's natural for African culture to resist being dominated. Our culture is who we are here. You know what I'm saying? That's how you identify somebody, by their culture. You know, and so for us, for the Gullah Geechee people, it was just like the Jamaican people. And then when you understand the history of South Carolina, so you don't get Gullah Geechee without South Carolina, so you got to start with the history of South Carolina. First of all, South Carolina is the state where the first Europeans first ever tried to colonize back in 1526. And the Africans that they took with them ended up rebelling along with the indigenous natives, who stood up and chased the Europeans back to the Caribbean, leaving the Africans behind with the natives. That happened in 1526 in South Carolina.
Oh, wow.
So when people say 1619, they must don't know about 1526, and they must don't include them Africans or them Europeans, and they don't recognize the first rebellion in the history of North America. And so that happened in 1526, even though people talk about 1619. And the only reason why they do that is because they say that the Spanish never established a permanent settlement, that they got chased away. And then they count the history of enslavement in America based on when the British colonized. And so that's 1619, and that's Virginia. But if you test the history, the Spanish actually colonized South Carolina and got chased back to the Caribbean by a group of Africans and indigenous natives who rebelled against their occupation. And that was 1526. So there's a lot of history that people don't know. And so we in my community, the Gullah Nation of North America, what we do, we recognize that it takes Africans to get Gullah Geechee. So we trace back to the first identifiable Africans that we can prove that were there. And so we look back to 1526 and say, well, that's when the first Africans first arrived in what today is known as the Gullah Geechee, Low Country, and Sea Islands. And that was by the Spanish and not by the British. And so when we understand that, we trace our heritage and our cultural connection to the land all the way back to those first Africans. That's the first thing. And then secondly, you got to understand that the Low Country of South Carolina and Georgia is the only place where Africans made up the majority during enslavement. And the Africans who were enslaved in the Chesapeake and Virginia and Maryland, they never made up the majority of the population. But in South Carolina and Georgia and that low country and Sea Island, we made up the bulk of the population. We outnumbered the whites. And so so our culture was strong simply because of, like you said, numbers is power. But where did the numbers come from? The numbers came from those who were born into slavery in South Carolina, first of all.
Yeah.
Also, there were those who were being brought from the Caribbean to South Carolina as well. And when, as I'm talking about the Caribbean, let me remind you also that it was the British colonizers from Barbados who came first with their captives, who came with their captives in 1670 and first created what became South Carolina. They're the first British colonizers of that land. And so some people will trace the origins of the Gullah Geechee back to that, but I like to say we're African first and foremost, and deliberately. In fact, we have a name to distinguish us from the white man. We call the white man the Bukra. And the Bukra can never be a Geechee. The Bukra can never be a Geechee. And so, we had a racial concept within how we understood ourselves. It wasn't just the culture and the language and the way we cooked and the food we ate. You had to be black.
That is one of the words I was referring to earlier. The word Bukra. It evolved to being Bakra in Jamaica, which means master, and that's an actual word in Jamaica.
Exactly. It's the same, and it's all related. Because what happened was, when the Europeans were colonizing the West African coast, when they were first setting up their trade fortresses and raiding the coast for captives, what happened was that they were able to subdue some of the coastal peoples and basically force them into a relationship with them. You understand? And those people there, they had to know how to talk with this European who came with this foreign language. You understand? And so the white man didn't just come with a different color. He came with a completely different language system. He came from a completely different language family. And so the people in this region who had to now communicate verbally with these people, they begin to develop pidgins. They begin to develop pidgin Englishes, like only to facilitate the communication with the cracker. And so they was doing those pidgins, and the different, like in Sierra Leone, Liberia area, there was a form of pidgin that developed strongly because for the first 200 years, the Portuguese was here dominant. And then the British came, and then the British influence overwhelmed it. But the Portuguese influence is still there in the pidgin. So you have Portuguese names. You have Portuguese words in Sierra Leone and Creole that goes all the way back to that transatlantic pidgin. And so this pidgin was developed in all the main regions where the British were involved in slave trading. And so down in in Ghana, they developed a different pidgin because the African language was different than the African language here. And so these pidgins have similarities because the language that they're going for is English, but the language that they're coming from may not even be related languages. And so that made a clear variety, a clear variant of pidgins that would be spoken. And so we know that there's a very strong relationship between Jamaica in particular and the Gullah Geechee, Barbados in particular, the Bahamas in particular, Cuba in particular, the Caribbean as a whole with the Gullah Geechee. We are one family. And then on top of that, we also know that we have a very, very strong kinship relationship to the people of what used to be known as the Rice Coast. And we know that because you do not get Gullah Geechee without rice. Even if there were Africans there already enslaved, you still do not get Gullah Geechee culture without rice. And so you don't get it without the people who were brought specifically to South Carolina and Georgia to produce that rice, because the European didn't know how to do it, and not every African knew how to do it. You had to get people from the regions, like the forest regions, where they knew how to dig ditches and dikes They knew how to control tidal waters. They knew how to basically cultivate rice without relying on the rain. They knew how to capture the coast through clear water and then
mm-hmm.
use that.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why we know that the Gullah Geechee culture had a very close relationship with the Low Country in particular, because on the sea islands, while you can grow rice, what they call dry rice, which is mm-hmm. using the rain, you cannot use salt water to grow rice. And so those sea islands was big on cotton, sugar, but the Low Country was the rice zones. And so the people who they targeted was between Senegambia and Sierra Leone, Liberia area, and mainly from this area. And so in 1750, there was a British private company that came to control Bunch Island slave fortress here in Sierra Leone,
mm-hmm.
only about
25 mm-hmm.
miles, 27 miles away from where I'm at right now. I'm in Freetown. I've been to this place. It's a very small island, about maybe a mile long, and it's about maybe not even that. And it
uh-huh.
is a it's so deadly. Like when you see it, you can just feel what happened there. And so this place was responsible for sending the bulk of the rice producers from this region over to that region, who had the skills, because they developed these skills in the south of this country in particular, and in the north as well, among the Timni people, among the Mende people, among the Vai people, among the Gola people, among the Gizi people. And so there are specific people that was being targeted for their rice production skills.
Yep.
And also
other
skills that they got from here was artisans. They also got people who knew how to herd animals, cowboys. So they got certain people for certain things. And then the culture that an African coming from Jamaica would meet in Charleston would be Gullah Geechee culture. The culture that the African coming from Bunch Island, Sierra Leone, direct, the culture that he would meet would be Gullah Geechee.
I'm not sure if we lost it there, Bode. Let's see if we do get you back. You went out for a while. So.
And wow, I was really about to, I had the best, well, I thought would be a good question to go into, really, from what I heard. Like, I'm so
Adriana.
Thankful. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, he's. I think we lost him, so we're gonna wait until he reconnects.
Okay.
So while he reconnects, we want to remind everyone that they could visit our website at sankofarepipe.com, where you can get information on our program, which is the Sankofa Repatriation Assistance Program. Our main mission is to assist our brothers and sisters set up businesses in the African continent, and we're gonna be targeting five countries at first, mainly. Sierra Leone is one who will be assisting our brothers and sisters set up businesses, the Gambia, Senegal, Nigeria, and Ghana. So you could help us and support us on this mission by going to sankofarepipe.com and also choose to become a monthly Patreon subscriber, where you could choose to donate as little as $1 per month. We've seen where a lot of our folks are doing more than that. And some have done substantially a lot more than that. But whatever you can, we do appreciate it. Adriana, you want to talk about our upcoming event in May, the 16th and the 17th?
Yes, please. If there is opportunity for people that are out there, you could be anywhere in the world. So we appreciate those people that have already partaken or interested in joining. Again, this is our opportunity to spread awareness for the program. So there's going to be 6 guest speakers there. There is opportunity for vendors to come. If you are interested in being a vendor, it's $100. The email that we provided, once again, you could go there and get more information or sign up at the www.sankofarepets.com.
Also, if they wanted to email us for more information, the email is admin@sankofarepets.com. And I think we have got Fode back on. You're back on, Fode. How you doing?
All right, thank you, brother. I'm sorry, man.
Not a problem.
Not an issue here.
Yeah, not a problem.
Thank you.
I understand. We didn't lose you for a minute.
Absolutely. I don't even know where I dropped off at. I was really trying to give you some hot fire.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And you definitely did. And I wanted to really say, like, thank you so much for all the information that you shared. I took a ton of notes and definitely will go ahead and pour, you know, into my knowledge, you know, that I didn't really have, or the history that I, you know, didn't have. What I was hearing really is a lot of opportunities that the British, the Spanish, the Europeans basically decided to do. They wanted to act, right? So I wanted to kind of hear from you about what kind of opportunities for business. Let me see. Are you seeking in Sierra Leone?
Well, business is definitely.
Or like, what kind
of
business opportunities? Yeah, what kind of opportunities for business? You know, are you seeking in Sierra Leone?
I think that the kind of businesses that I see that we can get into here is definitely import-export. I don't know if you guys know about what they call AGOA. It's the African Growth and Opportunity Act. It was signed into law. It passed through law. It's one of the last things that Bill Clinton did in the year 2000.
Yes. It's
supposed to make international trade between African countries that qualify or that have the privilege and the United States of America. And so, like right now in Sierra Leone, over the last 20 years, they have had the access, but recently I went to meet the Minister of Trade and Industry, and he told me straight up, he was like, man, did you start a business? Man, listen, AGOA, he's the one who said AGOA. He said, we got 5 years to get it going or they're going to take it from us. And so import-export is something major. I would also say that travel agencies, you know, tour companies, you know, things that will actually help to facilitate travel. Because as people come, you won't have to ask what opportunities are there. You're going to see them right away. There's opportunities in the transportation industry as well. You can hire so many unemployed youth who actually know how to drive and got licenses that are just rotting in the ghetto right now every day. And we're able to make transportation smoother. Right now the country is still developing the roads. The roads are they're becoming more wide, you know, they're becoming a lot more efficient. So I can see like trucking and transportation being something big, because agriculture is going to save this country. And if you're going to have agriculture, then you need good roads and you need transportation systems. And so
When you touch on, I don't really mean to cut you, when you touch on agriculture, can you talk about some of the produce that are popular? I know in Ghana you have cocoa. In the Gambia, I heard cashew is big there. What produce is good for Sierra Leone as it relates to agriculture?
Well, first of all, rice. Let me tell you that. This is the rice capital of West Africa. Traditionally, because here you have the Gola Forest. The Gola Forest is the first and the largest rainforest in West Africa. When I say first, I mean if you're coming from Africa north, and the first rainforest that you're going to meet is going to be the Gola Forest. That's where the name Gola is derived from, just like the name Gizi is derived from the word Gizi. These are people who used to occupy this land, this territory, and who were targeted heavily because of their rice production skills, and because they have become subjugated to internal wars to stronger powers. And so captives were exchanged. And so it's very important to understand that. But one of the things is ground nuts, cocoa. When I say ground nuts, When I say groundnuts, I mean peanuts. Gullah Geechee
okay.
say goobers.
Okay,
say goobers. Peanuts. And so and there's so much usage of it here. People use it for everything, everything.
Yeah.
It's magical because George Washington Carver, he invented
mm-hmm.
how many hundreds of ways for us to economize.
Oh,
and so,
wow. Yep.
And so here it just grows every 3 months, every 3 months, every 3 months you get a harvest all year round. So that's one area.
Wow.
Another area is cassava. Cassava grows, it's something that even a child knows the technique of growing. It's very easy to grow. A lot of times it's the woman
mm-hmm.
who control the cassava and the groundnuts, and usually the cash crop farming. The more heavy
mm-hmm.
farming, maybe the men will dominate it, but the light cash crop farming, the women dominate. The pepper, the ginger, they have ginger here. They also have, they produce the sweetest honey I've ever tasted in my life. Here.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Here. And so Sierra Leone's food production, the agricultural production is so rich. We have the richest soil on earth in terms of production. When you hear about gold and diamonds and earth, you should know that the soil is naturally minerally rich.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that Sierra Leone has Sierra Leone has the second largest deposit of iron ore? Do you know that we have one of the largest reserves of bauxite in this country, rutile, which is aluminum is made from. You know, the diamonds here are unmatched. They're the most precious diamonds on earth. This place is a heaven.
I'm literally sitting on the edge of my seat just listening to all the opportunities that exist there.
Yeah, man. Also the marine opportunities, the
mm-hmm.
fishing. Sierra Leone has the largest natural harbor in Africa. That's why the Europeans focused on this area, because they used to call it the watering hole. When they was coming with their boats, they'd be out there in the salt water. But here they had the largest natural harbor. They could water up. And so they identified this place as that. And so being that we have this mountainous peninsula, Freetown is established on a mountainous peninsula. So it's a peninsula like Florida, but
mm-hmm.
not so big. It's like a nose sticking out of West Africa. And it's a big mountain on top of it. I live on a mountainside right in the central city of Freetown. So that just lets you know how it is. So this is a landmark in and of itself. The land itself is a landmark. And so, of course, one thing that has always been the greatest bug, no pun, to the European has been the mosquito. The mosquito.
Uh-huh.
They call this place the white man's grave, because the white man could not deal with malaria. It would kill him flat. And then when you find the relationship between malaria and sickle cell and those who carry the trait, you understand that there is a direct relationship, that we had a superior defense mechanism within our genes on those plantations in South Carolina and Georgia that allowed us to survive even yellow fever and malaria. And so we already were accustomed to malaria, and our genes are already mutated in a way that is responsible for what we call sickle cell. And so even if you check, the largest rate of sickle cell is the people with ancestry in South Carolina and Georgia, because they exactly come from this region here in a large number. The other region is Angola. A lot of our ancestors came from Angola and the Congo, many from Nigeria and other places. But those three places right there was major. Now, if you know the history of Freetown, you know that in 1787, the first group of 400 African repatriates were brought back by the British from London. They were called the British Poor. And so they brought them back, but where did they bring them back from? They were Africans who were taken from plantations in the United States of America and evacuated by their loyalist masters and taken back to Europe and then left to be free. And so the anti-slavery movement picked them up and came up with an ideal to create a providence of freedom for freed Africans in Africa. And so this is the place where they decided to do it at. The first colony, it failed. But in 1792, the second group arrived, and they arrived in Nova Scotia, Canada, but they were evacuated from New York City and from Charleston, uh-huh. South Carolina. So many of them were Gullah Geechee, including the leader of the group, Thomas Peters.
Nice.
And so
this
is the group that came back and officially founded Freetown, Sierra Leone. So not only are a large percentage of Gullah Geechee ancestors taken directly from Sierra Leone via Bunch Island and Charleston Middle Passage, but also the founding group of Freetown, Sierra Leone, and ultimately the group that produced the Creole language here, which everybody talks now, and the Creole ethnic group, which also absorbed Jamaicans, it absorbed Trinidadians, it absorbed people who they call liberated Africans from Nigeria and Ghana and Angola and Congo over here, just like we did in Charleston. So it was the same culture, the same people, the same language. That's why Gullah Geechee traditional language and Sierra Leone Creole are identical. I didn't have a problem when I came here. I could hear the people talk because I could hear my mama and my uncles and my aunties and them talk.
Yeah. Wow.
Yep. That was interesting because that's something I learned recently, that there were actual, a lot of us going back as freed people. And that's something we're going to get into later on. I think we have our Sister Ya on the line. How are you doing, Sister Ya?
I'm fine, brother. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Welcome.
Hey, mama.
I'm fine. I'm fine. I just called in. Hey, sis. How you doing?
Yep. Always
how you
a pleasure
show,
to have you here, Sister Ya. So go ahead. I know you might probably have want to talk to Fody a little bit. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just called in to greet my brother. You know, Fode and I go all the way, way, way back, all the way, way back before he moved to Sierra Leone when I was still in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Yeah, so we've had a friendship spanning over almost a decade now.
Almost
a decade.
So I think we do have one caller online. We're going to allow the caller to ask a question, and then we'll continue, with some other questions for Fode. So caller, you're online. Just state your name and let us know the question that you have.
Hello?
Yes. How you doing? You're on. State your name.
Peace and blessings. This is Black America. Chris Black America.
Okay, great.
Hey, Black America. What's up, bro?
What's up, my brother?
All right.
Hey, man.
How
glad,
you doing, beloved?
I'm glad to be listening to y'all. Peace to Sister Ya as well. You know what I mean? And I'm looking forward to getting back to Sierra Leone. And I want to co-sign everything my brother was saying about the opportunities that are there in Sierra Leone. I myself am doing some work in Sierra Leone, business-wise and, culturally as well. I'm working with Brother Fode in what he's doing over there. I'm also working with Sister Ya. And, hey, man, I'm honored and proud to be part of this whole mission and movement. And I just want to say I love you all, and that's what's up.
Cool.
Thank you so much, brother. We appreciate all your efforts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Shout out, man. And thank you very much, man. Thank you very much, brother.
I just want to say to the listening public out there. Yes, for sure. Well, I want to say to anyone listening out there that, you know, you need to make it a priority to come and visit Sierra Leone. And you need to make it a priority to come to Africa because your heritage is in Africa. As the brother was telling you, you know, that's if you come from America, you call yourself a Black American. All the Black Americans that I know have history from the South. And I don't know anybody really who doesn't have history in the Carolinas and Georgia. My grandparents come from Georgia, and my father's side comes from the Carolinas. So, you know, we are our heritage and our roots is in West Africa and specifically in Sierra Leone. And we need to get back home immediately because, there's people that have their feet in our shoes. You know, the Chinese are building all the roads and highways. They're laying down all the infrastructure, and that's what we should be doing. We should be creating and laying down the infrastructure, building railroads, airports, you know, transportation companies, infrastructure companies, power companies, water companies. You know, I know many civil engineers, people who are plumbers, electricians. We need to be over in Africa handling our business because we're always crying about wealth. And we need to get over there and really lay down the foundations for our future health, for us and our continent. And we need to be focused on a unified Africa.
Yep. Thank you.
I want to piggyback off what my brother said. So you have these people who are repeating this rhetoric about, you know, why should we go over there and do this, and why, you know, my ancestors built this place. Okay. But you're not reaping the benefits of it. They did. Our ancestors built this. And my thing is, if our ancestors built this place, we have the knowledge and skill to go build something for ourselves that we can reap the benefits of, and that our grandchildren and children can reap the benefits of. And we're being asked to come home. And I just don't understand this mentality of people. Now listen. I'll just say like Donald Trump. Donald Trump owns properties all over the world. You can go set up something and do work over in Africa that can benefit you and your family financially. And if you just want to stay here, stay here. But why not go over there and take advantage of the economic benefits, the economic opportunities that are available to you there? Owning land, like my husband and I got land in 2013, and that land has quadrupled in price, and I'm pretty sure that's all over Africa. Yes, that's all over, and the price is still going up. So why not? Why not go and acquire assets outside of America that can still benefit your family? I you know, we have to start thinking like children. You know, we're not economically, we're not politically or economically mature people. You know, for a person to even say something like that, which I find so frustrating. So you want black people, black Americans or descendants of the slave trade to stay here and stay economically oppressed just because they built the place instead of going somewhere where there's opportunity. Even if their opportunity was, say, let's say that opportunity wasn't necessarily in Africa. Let's say it was in Ecuador. My oldest son now is in Ecuador, and he's telling me about all the opportunities that's available down there, how far your money can go down there. You know what I'm saying? Uh-huh. And so he's down there thinking about all the businesses he can start for basically a little of nothing. Why wouldn't he do that?
Why wouldn't you? So this is one of the main things you talked about is being able to set up something that you can leave for generations to come. You're talking about building your posterity.
What kind of opportunities here is being offered? I don't see that. I don't see that here. Like they're giving you opportunities for land in America, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So. I wanted to ask before he was gone, the Black America listener, like, how do people, I don't know if you're, like, on social media or anything, like, do you have anything to share with us or with me or we can share with people so I can follow?
Absolutely. I am on social media. I have my Instagram is Homeland Journey Sierra Leone, and I'm also running trips, taking people back and forth to Sierra Leone. I've been going back and forth to Sierra Leone for 5 years. I'm in the process of setting up several businesses, purchasing land, et cetera, et cetera. I'm also working with Brother Fode as the International Development Coordinator of one of his organizations there. He's my good brother. He is one of the most brilliant people that I've met in this world, and I met a lot. I know thousands of people. He's a real, serious, and true African king, you know what I mean? And he has resurrected to help, you know, lay down the foundations for our reconstruction of our African civilization. That's one. Two, in reference to what Sister Yah said, in which she said, we are not a mature people. And that is true. We are not a mature people. You know, we have been through some extreme psychological trauma And even if you think about this, Harriet Tubman was freeing people during American so-called slavery. And most of the people she did free, most people didn't go. Most people didn't even want to go because they were like, felt like, well, you know, we don't know what's out there.
Right.
Here on the plantation. That way we know Master, he might beat us, but at least we know he's going to feed us. That's still the mentality of black people here in America and all the ADOS and, you know, I'm a Moor and an Israelite. That's what's going on with those people. What it is they don't know what they're talking about. They haven't been on the continent. They haven't done any research, actual real physical research.
Exactly.
They're having all these debates and ridiculous conversations about things that they absolutely know nothing about because they don't have the actual proof in their own hands. They're afraid to get on an airplane and fly across the world and see for themselves when they walk into West Africa and see people that look like them, their friends and family, I mean, identical. They will see a phenotype that looks identical to them. You're not going to go to Mexico and see anybody who has your phenotype. It's not going to happen. We are not indigenous to the Americas. Maybe we came here before white people, but we are not indigenous to here. So even when people say, oh, well, my ancestors, you know, built this place. Well, our ancestors built Egypt. Our ancestors built everything in Africa right now. Our ancestors are still in Africa right now. Our brothers and sisters and cousins are there right now. So who cares if your ancestors were here and died? Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't matter because guess what? If you have 500 years of ancestry here, you have as long as human beings have been on the planet, that's how long
years and more.
That's how old your ancestry is on the continent. And just because just because you don't know anybody by name, that's because you haven't gone and visited and met people who are related to you. Just like if you go to a family reunion, there will be people there that you have never met before. You do not know their name. And you go there and then you meet them. And if you need to, you can take a DNA test, and that DNA test will tell you what ethnic group you come from. Then you can go to that ethnic group, as Fode will manifest to, and if you say, hey, listen, I am Mende, I am Soso, I am whatever you say you are, you can go to those people, and they receive and accept you back into their family. They will give you a name. They will advise you. They will help you to acquire land. They will help you do whatever you want, similar to what my brother Dinus is doing in Nigeria in January when he was in Sierra Leone and he came and he dealt with us. And he went to visit his people, the Mende there, and they received him, and they gave him a name, and they gave him status. Proof is in the pudding. We have people, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of people. 10,000 people a month are going to Ghana alone. And that's not even counting people who are going to Senegal, Nigeria, you know, the Gambia. You know how many people are moving and repatriating to the Gambia, to Ghana? And now now we're coming to Sierra Leone. We are already moving to Africa. So the people who have doubts, they're just being ridiculous. And, you know, they need to, excuse my language, they need to get their head out their asses and stop, you know, sucking on the white man's titty. Because that's what it really boils down to. They're really sucking on the white man's titty, and they don't want to let him go. They don't want to let his whip go. They don't want to let his sense of self go. They don't want to let his internet go. They don't want to let the thing that they feel that they can't have without him.
Yeah, maybe it's a part of the thing where I think it's a part of the thing where they don't want to come out of their comfort zone.
Yeah.
So you're in this comfort zone and you get comfortable with a lot of things that you don't want to give up when there are important things out there for you to go pursue. So we're going to try and jump back to Fode. Thanks for calling in, Black America.
Peace and blessings to everybody. And, you know, many roots, one fambo.
One fambo.
One fambo. That's right. Man.
Okay.
Hey, Black America, man, one love. I really appreciate you, man. I really appreciate you bringing that energy. Everything you said, you know, is on point. Let's keep building, man. Repatriation now. Sankofa is the way.
Yeah, so Brother Fode, there are three organizations that are not part of the about those real quick. The first one is the Black Star Action Network International. Tell me how did that come about and why did you start that movement?
Okay. In 1999, my mother, she wanted to save me from a bad life, and she introduced me to an organization in my community that was training organizers. You know, we were going out doing clean sweeps. We assisted with the 2000 census, and they trained us. They trained us up. They taught us how to develop plans of actions and, you know, implement strategies at the grassroots level, utilizing resources and from stakeholders and wherever we can get them from the community, and also really promoting volunteerism as a key aspect of human development, not only in getting things done, but with the internal development of a person when they volunteer. So my mother, for about 10 years, man, she struggled with drugs very bad when I was growing up, between about age 7 to about age 17 for me. And then she got off the drugs and things like this. But, you know, one of the things that really got her back on her feet and back to her stature in the community was that she became a community volunteer. Every Saturday, she would have us, me, my siblings, and other people knocking on people's doors. Everybody bringing their brooms out. You know, everybody got their bags. We would clean the community up. So there were exercises that my mother was doing, and she wanted other people to be involved because she was being clean, literally. You know, she was literally being clean. And so later on, in 1999, she introduced me to this group. I got some training. And then ultimately, I ended up, you know, going through a whole bunch of different stages, man. You know, once you know something, that's half of the story. But then the ultimate solution is, what are you going to do about it? You know? And so I began to use the information. I began to apply what I had learned to every aspect of my life. Organizing is something that you can apply anywhere. I begin to organize even my relationships with my family, with my friends. I begin to use basic organizing tools in how I would develop my relationships with people. So beyond that, I also begin to get involved in activism. I strongly identify with Marcus Garvey. I am a Garveyite. You know, I got involved. You know, I attended the event.
Nice.
You know, I organized the protests. You know, I did all the Black Power shouting and fist pumping and RBG. You know, I got all that out of my system early on because, of course, you know, consciousness is a development process. You don't just wake up one day conscious. You know, you have to evolve through the stages. And so now I can look back over the last 20 years and say, okay, well, this is where I was at then. But back then I didn't know. I thought I had it going on. You know what I'm saying? And so as I progressed in 2009, after being a member of several organizations and it just not working out for me personally, my style of organizing, and I've seen it as a lot of rhetoric and not a lot of sustainable activities, institution building.
Yeah.
And so I was looking. I'm like, man, in 2007, I started getting hooked up with Africans. I started working with them. Man, I would really like to be able to do something that would validate the logic of Marcus Garvey and the UNIACL when they said Black Star Liner. The reason for the Black Star Liner was to reconnect African people. And also to facilitate travel, trade, you understand, and repatriation. You understand?
Okay.
Those were the three. That was the reason why the UNIACL chose to create a Black Star Line, was to facilitate those three things. And so when you say the Black Star, that's where that comes from. Our movement is a Garveyite movement. It was influenced by Marcus Garvey. And then we're an action network
which operates internationally. We have members in Israel, we have members all across America, we have members in other countries in West Africa, and we are a network of Pan-Africanists who adhere to the principles and the practice of Garveyism in the 21st century. And that's who we are. We engage in grassroots empowerment activities. We're not funded by anybody. Everything that we do is fundraised, mainly online. We take pennies and we work miracles. And a lot of things we do as well is we do some media services. We have a monthly newsletter that comes out called Forward March Newsletter. We have a website. Mm-hmm. We're always putting out, energy to facilitate more unity. Now, the purpose that I created the Sunday for was to create a model for how Africans in the diaspora and Africans on the continent can practically and principally work together in a common communal development, meaning that how can you supporting the movement here support your community there? How can we make that work? No one else will ask these questions. You can't expect our oppressor or our exploiters or our traders to ask these questions. These are the people. And so we wanted to create that. And so in 2009, I began the process. 2011, we formed our first steering committee, and we reconnected with the people in Sierra Leone, our comrades who we had met back in the early 2000s. So we was just like launching and just coming off for the first time as a new movement. And and so we officially launched on February 19th, 2012 in Tampa, Florida. Our featured guest was the late Elhaj Malcolm Shabazz, the grandson of Malcolm X, who was also one of our first members. And we identify him as a martyr of our movement, because if he was not murdered or assassinated in Mexico, he would still be with us today. He would still be befriending today. And so he was one of the featured guests. And another one was Honorable Harold Taylor. Harold Taylor was a Black Panther Party member. He was recruited by Bunchy Carter. He was L.A. This brother was Black Liberation Army, and he also was one of the San Francisco Eight. If you know about that case, there was the killing of police officers in San Francisco, and the case went originally when they arrested them, they used a lot of torture, cattle prodded them, was choking them, and they got confessions. And then the judge threw the case out. Well, in the early 2000s, they brought the case up after 30 years. And so he became a political prisoner for something that actually got thrown out in the courts 30 years prior. And so he was at the time one of the political prisoners, elders who was out there, fighting for Mutulu, keeping the Black Panther spirit going. And he came down to Tampa. And we had a great show. We had a great event. Brother Crown Dion was there. It was so many other people. Brother Kofi was there. I think he worked with Sister Yai. He actually recorded our launch event in Tampa. Yes. And so, we have been doing that. No longer than a week after that, Trayvon Martin was killed. When Trayvon Martin was killed, I realized that he had family in Tampa and that the Tampa community was hurt by that because he was known. And then the place where he had got murdered at happened to be where my sister-in-law was from. And they had just moved to Tampa. Her and my brother had just moved to Tampa. So it was very local to us. And it happened within a week of this. And so we immediately responded. We immediately got involved in the Justice for Trayvon activities. Protested, we did what we had to do. And then we had an event on April 7th, 2013. It was called Organize the Hood, From Trayvon to Security and Self-Defense in the Black Community. We organized it at the same place where we organized our launching. And so that's how Bassani originated then. But then ultimately, we got involved with our international
partners, and it was opportunity on the table for me to come to Africa.
Opportunity focused. Now the movement, becomes more opportunity focused, and how can we impact the community? So I see a lot of the work that you're doing in Sierra Leone, which I'm going to get to in a minute. But I want to also have you talk to us about how do you serve as an ambassador for the West Africa region under the UNIA-ACL Rehab Committee.
Okay, absolutely. Well, like I said, I've been a Garveyite for most of my life now.
Yeah.
In terms of being conscious about being race first, and you know, being on my people's side, and being down to do whatever is gonna make us win. You know, if a black man is fighting somebody in a karate movie, I'm rooting for the black man. Even if he get beat up, I feel some kind of way about it. You know, I'm race first. I want to see us win. But ultimately, back in, I believe it was 2012, I was organizing a tour for the brother from Sierra Leone who I met back in 2007. And I had got back in contact with the UNIAACL, and Malcolm Shabazz was actually supposed to be on that tour, but he ultimately didn't go on the tour. So we came up with a list of organizations that would be open to it. And of course, the UNIAACL supported us in that. One of our tour stops was at the Liberty Hall in Philadelphia, and it was pretty dope. Either way, I became an official member of the UNIAACL in 2014. I joined the division in America. Although I'm here, I'm a repatriate. You know, I still have the ability. I joined there and then basically got busy. So what we did was we formed a division, and that division utilized and partnered with Bassani, because after we launched in America, when I came to Sierra Leone, the purpose was to reestablish Bassani and to bridge this Atlantic. And so from 2013 to 2018, Bassani was the community-based organization that we were organizing and implementing. You understand? And so Bassani and the UNIAACL Freetown Division became one. They became one, and the work became the same. And so with this rehabilitation committee, that you see, 2020, it comes as a result of complications, I would say contradictions at the top of the older structure that was in place. After Marcus Garvey was deported, well, before he was deported, when he was in prison in Atlanta, there was a Negro convention that was held in New York in his absence, and the same people who conspired against him to get him in prison, they also conspired to basically do a election coup of Marcus Garvey while he was in prison. And so they did that. They actually kicked Garvey out of his own organization and put another president general there while he was a political prisoner. At that convention, when it happened, there was a group of loyalists who stood up, and they protested the action of the others. But then they walked out, and they had another convention where they reinstated Marcus Garvey as the president general. And so there was a split in the UNIAACL while Marcus Garvey was in prison that most people don't know about. The ones who split, they split with the documentation. They split with the actual incorporated documents that Marcus Garvey first created when he got there. And then he split with his loyalists who were committed to creating a provisional government for Africa. And so this is where you get UNIA members, and then you got the Garveyites. The Garveyites are those who rode with Garvey after he got deported and became his students. The only book that he ever wrote is the message to the people, race first. He wrote that book to train his cadre. Marcus Garvey actually trained a whole new generation of Garveyites before he passed away in 1940. You understand? And so those people kept his legacy alive and continued to build the government.
And so, what Marcus Garvey did when he went to Jamaica was as a rehabilitation committee, because he wanted to rehabilitate the UNIACL. And so he didn't call it a rehabilitation committee, but one of his students who became a president general after his death, named Thomas W. Harvey, who led the organization from Philadelphia, with international headquarters still resides. We have the oldest UNIA Liberty Hall that actually the people bought. Is only a short distance from Temple University in Philadelphia till this day. And so this brother, he formed the rehabilitation committee, of course, to bring things back together, to try to rehabilitate the government and make things happen properly. And this was in the 50s. And so that rehabilitation committee went from then up until 1972. After that, there was no need for a rehabilitation committee because, you know, basically they had come to unity and exhausted the attempt. But now in 2020, we realize that everybody is screaming RBG, RBG, Marcus Garvey, but nobody are members of the IAACL. Why aren't you building Marcus Garvey's legacy? And if there's something wrong inside, let us go inside and fix it. Let us not stand on the outside and criticize. With that logic, I chose to put my Garveyite work and align it with the work of Marcus Garvey and help to rehabilitate this legacy organization that means something to every African on the earth. And so the Rehabilitation Committee was formed out of veteran UNIA members, even former President General Senghor Baye, who functions on the Rehabilitation Committee as the first assistant president general under our President General Akili Nkrumah, who is both of them. They have over 40 years in the UNIACL. They both were trained by people. They were trained by former President General Charles James, who was trained by Marcus Garvey, and he actually scored highest in the university. In terms of ideological transference, you know, getting that Garveyism from Garvey and then getting it from his student and then getting it from this student, these are the kind of people who decided that it's time for us to rehabilitate the UNIACL along with so many others. We have divisions in the Caribbean, we have divisions in America, we have divisions also in production in Europe, and we have this West African division as well. We have the Black Star Division in Ghana right now, being formed by one of our ambassadors, Brother Tshaka Shumani. And so we have elders like Baba Mosi, Baba Charles. Yeah. We have so many great, prominent Garveyites that really fit the legitimate classification because of the work that they've done and the knowledge that they have.
Brother Fode, so one of the things about, probably let's speak to our Jamaican folks, is that whenever we look into the Honorable Marcus Garvey, we might say he founded the UNIA back in the 1920s. We might think this is an historical event and might lead us pause to think that the UNIA is like a historical thing, but it's alive and kicking, is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying. And I'm saying that right now, 2020 is the 100th year commemoration of the first International Negro Convention that was held in New York City, Harlem, in the Madison Square Garden, which hosted over 20,000 Africans from all around the world. Marcus Garvey had an organization that had thousands of divisions in dozens of countries at one time. And they had members who went to this international convention, like the UN or something. And they sat there and they did several things. First of all, they created a provisional government for Africa and African people at home and abroad. They created the actual government structure. They declared us sovereign, first of all. Secondly, Marcus Garvey was elected the first president general of this new government that the UNIA ACL was now going to work to bring into actuality
to the fullest extent. Thirdly, there was a Declaration of Negro Rights. It's something like the Bill of Rights in the United States, where it's like our Declaration of Independence. Like, we have these rights, and you don't got, no one has a right to stop us from having these rights. We also established a national flag for all African people, even those who may not identify with it, a racial flag, red, black, and green. And so the flag was created also in August 1920. Yeah. And so this year we're commemorating that. And so we're looking back and like, wow, we should be far ahead. Yeah. We should be far ahead. The UNICEF should be far ahead. It should have more young people involved.
So, Brother Foday,
no one should be confused about our history. You understand?
So, in the interest of time, we are working
to rehabilitate the legacy of Marcus Garvey, Amy Garvey. Mm-hmm. You can't get Marcus without Amy and the millions of ancestors who made it possible for us even to have a red, black, green flag today, a sense of black nationality anywhere we are in the world today.
So, Brother Foday, if someone wants to read the Bill of Rights that you mentioned earlier, where could we find that?
You could be able to find it. It should be right online somewhere. It's the Negro Rights Declaration of Negro Rights, UNIAACL. Should be easily found. You can, should easily be able to find it with just a Google. It's out there.
Okay, cool. So real quick, I wanted to just speak to one. I watched a video with you and Brother Dynas in Sierra Leone, where you were showing off this seaside area where you were trying to clean up. Can you give us an update on that? For all our listeners, you could go on YouTube and search for Dynas, and the video is While the Conscious Community is Still Debating Aliens. You can search for that video and you can watch what we're talking about. Can you give us an update on that area and tell us how we can help here in the diaspora?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the area is basically divided into two communities now. But generally, the area is called King Jimmy. And the main site in the area is a historic marketplace. And this historic marketplace had been a marketplace since before the Europeans arrived at the coast of West Africa. So this is a traditional market site. And even today, the people still come from the northern parts, where they come with fish. They come with exclusive fish to this King Jimmy market, even today, three days of the week. The same 3 days that they used to come before the Europeans came. And so there's a traditional connection. You know, this is an unbroken cycle since before enslavement, since before European arrival, that's still there. First of all, this is a living marketplace. This is living heritage, living culture. So King Jimmy was, first of all, a marketplace, but it also became a place where at one time the Europeans were fighting themselves over control of this coastline. And the British had basically dominated it, but the Dutch also was fighting with them. They would be allies sometimes, other times they would be enemies. They got that kind of relationship between Germans and Britons, because if you know, the British people are German, Anglo-Saxons and Jutes. That's Germanic tribes. They just migrated and took over the island. They took over the island. And so they're actually relatives. They're actually relatives. And so you always see the Germans and the British moving together. That's their kinship to the Americans, that WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. You understand? And so there's a connection between all of that. Anyway, King Jimmy was a place where at one time there was a guy named Admiral, what was his name? Admiral De Ruyter. He was a Dutch admiral, I would say pirate. But there was different British trade forts established throughout the many, many sea islands along this coast. And one of them was Tasso Island. It was one of the big islands. And so what happened was the Dutch, some of their sailors, while they were on the island that's controlled by the British, they were beat up and abused. In retaliation, this Admiral De Ruyter, he goes and he destroys the fortress. He goes and bombs it with cannons. He destroys it. And then in order to celebrate it,
he went to the same location as the King's Indian Market and etched his name on stone. And him and the sailors went there and celebrated the victory over the British by etching their name on a stone. So there's like a Rosetta Stone that was started then. So what happened was all along the West African coast where European sailors would go, they would tag. Mm-hmm. They would tag their names on these different stones. So this stone mm-hmm. had the names of people mm-hmm. like John Hawkins there. It has the name of people like Francis Drake there. You understand? Uh-huh. And so it,
we do have about 4 minutes left, so we're gonna try to get as much.
Okay, let me finish up.
I think we're gonna need to have like a part two. But go ahead.
Exactly, because you have so much knowledge, and I'm like really like, wow, thank you.
Okay. So
like classes
today, today King Jimmy is still a market on the same days, but the conditions of the place is like living in a sewage. It's completely neglected by the city. The inhabitants are very poor, and it looks like a slum dwelling. So we, as a Gullah Redemption Mission Sierra Leone, a nonprofit company with limited guarantee and membership, we have created a program called the King Jimmy Redemption Project, where we're going down to King Jimmy to first develop a relationship with the people who live there in a way where we can empower the young women and the young men. We have registered over 200 people as members there already. And just two days ago, we worked some of them on a cleanup exercise. And so we are transferring skills through a program called the Community Disaster Management Committee so that they know how to take care of themselves when no one else is there, because obviously no one cares about the place. Now, they have historic relics on the site. They have a wall of chains where they actually chained our ancestors. They have a jetty there. We call this gateway. We call it the gateway because this is the only place in Africa where Africans were taken away during slavery and brought back to after being liberated from slavery. And so it is the only place, and it's also the first place where Africans re-arrived back in Africa from the diaspora as repatriates. King Jimmy is our gateway. It's where we return to first. And there will be no Freetown without King Jimmy. There will be no Creole people or Creole culture without King Jimmy. There would be no free time without King Jimmy.
Yeah.
It's very neglected.
Yeah. One other question that I didn't get to was for you to tell me about the Jamaican Maroons that are living in Freetown, because I remember from my studies, I saw that some free Jamaicans were called Maroons in Jamaica. They went to Nova Scotia, and then they went back to Sierra Leone, and their descendants are living there now. So, but we ran out of time. We're going to have a part two. I want you to give us some information. Let's say we wanted to donate so you could, carry on the mission that you're doing there. Do you have a website? How do we send you some funds? And your social media contact information and all of that.
Okay, no doubt. Well, my email is gulladugu, gullahdugu @gmail.com. My website is www.gullahdugu.com. What's the goal for me?
Are you on social media?
Okay. My
I think I found you on Facebook.
My GoFundMe is Gullah Redemption. GoFundMe, right? If you go to GoFundMe,
get that information from you by a text or so, and then I'm going to add it to the show notes, so it will always be in there. But we have 1 minute, 60 seconds, so we're just going to go ahead and close out. We're going to have to do a part two. There's a lots and lots of information to dig into. There's a lot that we did not get into. So go ahead. We want to thank you very much for taking the time out with us tonight, brother.
Yeah, thank you as well, brother. Really I appreciate it, man.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you,
Adriana, for being our co-host tonight. We thank you.
Thank you, co-host. You did great.
Thank you. Thank you so much for all the information.
Okay.
No problem.
Okay, so any final words? I guess we have 30 seconds for final words, and that will be many roots.
One fan ball.
Yep, yeah. There you go. Many roots, one famble. That is our
one
final
famble.
Word for the night. One famble.
Yeah, man. Brother.
Thank you very much for calling in and sharing all this knowledge with us tonight. We do appreciate you. Adrian, I want to thank you again for being our co-host tonight.
Thank you.
We really do. Yep, we really do appreciate it. And that is our show for tonight. Thanks to all of our listeners. Remember to check us out on Sankofa.repat.com. Have a great day.